Good evening and welcome to Valley Voices, where we bring you conversations covering all things local from news, politics, and government to culture and community issues that are relevant to Lehigh Valley residents. I'm your host, Margaret McConnell, the Executive Director at WDIY, and tonight's show is in honor of Veterans Month coming up in November. This is a time where we honor the service and sacrifices of all veterans and their families. I want to give a personal shout out to the veterans in my life, my brothers, Matt and John. Joining me tonight is Jenny Pekanowski, a combat veteran turned poet and public speaker. Her passion is to provide reintegration programming utilizing writing and performance to empower the veteran service member experience. Service members are trained to survive. Her program aims to help them thrive. Women Veterans Empowered and Thriving secures a space of non-judgment, kindness, and compassion for self, most importantly, and for others. Also here with us is Chris Yarnell. He is a veteran advocate and founder of Battle Born, and he's a public speaker. Chris, with the help of his wife Cadence, founded Battle Born. They are one of the youngest veteran nonprofit organizations in the Lehigh Valley. Their mission is to serve those who have served us by providing services and resources to meet their needs. And with him is Mike Cubbage, who is the chief legal officer for Battle Born. Welcome to all of you. Jenny, we're going to start with you. Tell us about your time in the military, what it taught you, and what stays with you.
Thank you for having me tonight. I'm really honored to be here. My journey began with telling my story about my military service. It was complicated, and it was exciting. I joined in 2003 to pay off my student loans and to start getting medical training to be a nurse. By 2004, I was in Iraq doing medical evacuation support. So if you consider it like 911 in a combat zone. And on the bases, so green zone, and also within, you know, experiencing improvised explosive devices, RPGs, small arms fire, ambushes, and then being the medical support on hand to get the service members the medical support they need to get to the hospital.
And what branch were you in?
I was in the Army.
How long was your service?
From 2003 to 2007. I got off active duty at 2005 and ended up actually in a legal battle with the military because they decided not to pay my student loans off. So I had a lot of struggle right off the bat, feeling betrayed by the military because I upheld my end of the deal of becoming a medic and serving in Iraq. I really was searching for other veterans that necessarily didn't have great experiences in the military because I felt very alone and betrayed. And it really led me to what I do now. But to provide a space for all experiences, whether they're celebration, triumph, struggle. That's a lot of confusion with our organization. People think they have to show up at the workshop and talk about their worst trauma. And I was like, you can talk about how pretty the sky is and like create this community. And then when we partner with like Battle Born, we can connect them directly to resources when they identify the problems that they're having within the stories, within the workshop. We call it a reintegration program. So we developed and designed the structure of how to come home, mind, body, and spirit. Like, what are the things you need to practice? I didn't want people to come to workshop and not get anything out of it except being in the room, which is beautiful. Like, peer support groups, right, being in the room, relating to each other. This is beautiful work, but it's not exactly what we do. Mm-hmm. We want them to have skills to take into their life.
You talked a little bit already about your transition out of service and that it prompted you to start this nonprofit. Tell us a little bit about the work, a little more about the work of Women Veterans Empowered.
We have about six workshops a month, one at Battle Born, in-person, hybrid. When we started, we were women veterans only, but now the workshops are open to men, LGBTQIA+, civilian support members, family members, because they have a story too. They can give us a reflection of what happened when we were away or what's happening in our homes. So now as we move into performance, we invite the family members to tell their story or the community reflections after the veterans tell their story. It's all designed after ancient warrior cultures.
Oh.
So the Greeks, the Romans, the Native Americans, they had these magnificent storytelling rituals, and it reunited the community instantly. Everyone was talking about what happened in military service or in the war, and we've lost that.
The way that our society sort of operates on normally is we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't ask how it was.
Yeah, we're trying to take the stigma away.
Right.
To have the veterans tell their stories to each other first.
Yes.
In the workshop, in a secure space. We don't throw around the language safe space because we don't know how you feel in your body or even in your environment or even at home.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of domestic violence. There's a lot going on in our veteran community.
Yeah.
So we really want to address that. We're going to agree to secure this space together.
Right.
And then have that vulnerability.
Yeah. So I want to go to Mike. Tell me a little bit about your journey.
Most of the men in my family have served, so it was always a possibility of me going into the military. I think after college, I was intent on flying F-18s for the Marine Corps. That was the goal. But my freshman year of college, I was at Western Maryland on a wrestling scholarship, and we were close enough to Baltimore that when the Pentagon was hit, we could stand on the hill and see the Pentagon burn.
Mm-hmm.
While I was on the phone with my father, who was in his office in Jersey City watching the towers get hit.
Oh.
And my family comes from Philadelphia and Brooklyn, New York. So, you know, that hit close, very close to home for us. But I graduated from Easton High School. And then after experiencing that, my freshman year, I transferred back home to Temple. Bigger school, more assets and resources. And the war in Iraq started.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So on my birthday, I was sitting watching CNN, watching the 101st Airborne invade Baghdad. And I walked down to the recruiting station. And I finished out my sophomore year. 2 months later, I was in basic training at Fort Benning. I came in on a special program called the 18 X-ray Special Forces Street Recruit Program. So I was destined to go straight to Special Forces after infantry school and airborne school. But while in training at Fort Bragg, I had severe injuries to my femur, so I wasn't able to jump for about a year. So I was sent to the 101st Airborne. While I was there, I served as a sniper while in combat in Iraq and an infantry team leader. And then upon return, I was an E5 at the time as a sergeant, and I was picked by my command to compete for a program called the Green to Gold program to become an officer. I was chosen for that, which was amazing. I mean, there were 200 of us chosen Army-wide out of 2,000 applicants. So I was stoked about that. They gave me my choice to go back to whatever college I wanted to go to. And I got in pretty much everywhere I wanted to get in or could get in, you know, and I picked Temple because I wanted to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back, graduated from Temple in 2009, was commissioned as a second lieutenant, spent about 6 months at Temple University's Military Science Department as a public affairs officer, an officer recruiter, and an assistant military science instructor. Then from there, I went back to Fort Benning after several injuries. I mean, over the course of my career, I fractured my back 5 times, my neck twice, both of my femurs. And then when I retired, right around 8.5 years, I was medically retired as a O2E, a first lieutenant, in a captain's billet. At that point, I had 2 BAs and MA, and I was looking to go federal law enforcement or federal CIA, you know, intelligence agency kind of stuff. So I was getting recruited pretty heavily by most of the alphabet soup agencies, and one of the recruiters reached out and said, hey, look, you're extremely marketable, but there's so many people. This was 2011 when there was, you know, 60,000 of us under Obama were let loose under the troop drawdown. The recruiter said, hey, you know, if you go get your JD, you're going to be at top of, you know, you're going to be untouchable. So I went to law school, NSU in Fort Lauderdale, Nova Southeastern University, and I graduated in 2014 and was destined to go to the FBI Miami field office for a hostage rescue team, which was the goal, and we went on federal sequestration that year. So that my academy date was canceled.
Oh, wow.
So 3 years spent in law school with the entire goal of never actually practicing law, but just to be marketable to these agencies.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? This is the last time I'm going to let the government give me what for, you know, I'm going to start my own company.
Okay.
So I wrote a book, A Veteran's Guide to Higher Education. I said, you know what, with what I know with from the tactical standpoint, the military standpoint, my network within the military and my academic career, I mean, was rival to my military career. So why not do this on my own?
Mm-hmm.
what motivated me to write that book was I had a lot of issues when I got out. PTSD, yeah. You know, TBI issues. I was injured while I was in Iraq and like I said, throughout yeah. my, you know, garrison career. I said, if I had a field manual like we have in the military that says, hey, look, this is what you got to do, because what do we do in the military? We plan. There's your primary objective, your secondary, your alternate plans. So you have to make your academic career look just like your military career so that you plan for any contingencies.
Yep.
So when you can't go to an appointment because there's a mandatory American Bar Association attendance policy and you have to miss school more than they allow because you have to go to mandatory VA appointments in order to get the education benefits that pay the school that have the policy. So I helped change that policy for attendance under the Americans with Disabilities Act to apply to veterans who had mandatory VA appointments. So I saw that I was able to start affecting some things. And, you know, it teaches you how to write resumes, how to transfer your military skill set from not putting on your, you know, I'm applying as a manager to a bank branch. You probably don't want to put on there that you're, a, you know, expert 240 machine gun marksman, you know. But how does that transfer? You've got technical skills.
Right.
You know, you're an infantry team leader. Well, you're a manager. You're a supervisor. Mm-hmm. And every responsibility that comes with it in the military will translate to civilians.
Right.
So, I mean, like you were saying, it's we have a lot of marketability where people don't know how to market it right or they don't know how to get their story out.
Right.
And then Chris reached out to me in 2018 when he was starting Battleborn and for a little bit of advice on the 503 legal. I took on the position as soon as I got home and I've been, you know, me and Chris have been attached at the hip pretty much since I've been back. You know, I'm honored to be a part of the organization. It's helped me in magnificent way just to get myself back out socially amongst other veterans and civilians. Because they say that we have to learn how to re-assimilate. No, we have to learn how to assimilate. Because we never were civilians. We went from being kids to being soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors. And come back to the civilian world that we never knew. Most of us were straight out of high school. Or early
20s.
So we didn't have the experience of life before we went to the military. So we go straight out the military into this civilian world. And we don't know how to act.
Yeah, the cultures are different.
It is. It's two different cultures,
like
two different worlds.
All over again. Well, and then if you think, like, just neuroscience real quick, the brain is very malleable between 18 and 25, and that's when we receive all of our military training. So then when you take these military members who were trained exactly to be in the military culture and don't retrain them for their civilian world, that's what leads to the suicide, the addiction, the isolation, not wanting to tell our story, because literally our brains are telling us that's not allowed.
Right.
And that's why we created our model, same, like a guide. Like we print out the worksheets, you take them with you, you practice this thing, because we learned in the military, repetition.
Right.
You cannot create new neural pathways without that repetition.
So Chris, I know you have a bit of a different journey as far as your service.
Well, thank you for having me. To my military service, I'm, like as you said, not like Jenny and Mike. I come from a military career family. Grandfather served in World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. My dad was in the Army, and he was one of the first documented veteran suicides. I lost my dad on the first day of high school in 1989. It was September 7th. But my Marine Corps beginning was basically, as Mike said, Eastern kid, rough around the edges, couldn't tell me anything, didn't like school. I was a wrestler, I was athletic, and I could see that I was going down a very rough road after high school. I was already getting in trouble. I actually had to get a waiver to get into the military because I had been in trouble. And the Marines do not take you with even traffic violations.
Wow.
So back to being the Marine is I signed up on delayed entry, and I remember going home one day, and I had been looked at for wrestling scholarships, and I didn't even want to wrestle anymore. And I remember telling my dad and my grandfather, this was junior year, I said, thinking about joining the military like you guys. And they said, oh, yeah? What are you going to do? I said, I like the Marines, man, because that's the time they had the commercial with the guy with the sword, the feud, the proud,
the Marines.
You know, and I was like, I want to have a sword. And my grandfather and my dad both looked and said, ah, you won't make it. That's all I needed to hear. I'll show you, right? So I signed up delayed entry, And I got out of high school in 1993, and I left for boot camp on February 2nd, 1994. I ended up getting injured in boot camp, and they tried to medically platoon me back. I convinced the corpsman and the commander in the Navy, the doc, that I could go back to rifle range training. And I did. And I ended up graduating boot camp. I went off to Marine Corps combat training. I got injured again in the field. They let me come back in after finishing combat training and before MOS school. I got taken back in, and they pretty much said, we would like to medically discharge you. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a part I probably need to share with you that I had planned on being a career Marine.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
I had planned on retiring after 20 years. I didn't see any other future for myself. So that caused a lot of mental turmoil.
Yeah.
I actually had said, I don't want that. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, then we're going to have you sign this little piece of paper that says, if you end up crippled, we are not responsible.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's called a page 11. So I said, can I have some time to think about it? And they said, sure. We'll give you like 2 weeks. I called home. I had a girlfriend who was just became my fiance who just miscarried. The grandparents who raised me were getting old. The doctor looked at me across the table when I went back in, and I'll never forget this. He said, what do you got to prove, kid? You did all the hard stuff. He said, as athletic as you are, your knees are not going to continue to hold up. Like, I had actually, when I had woke up in boot camp after tweaking my knee and not telling anybody, I woke up and my leg from my hip to my toes was purple. So they sent out the ambulance in the middle of rifle range, which is in the middle of nowhere. Little funny story, and I know they're going to laugh at me for telling this. I'll never forget when they put me in the back of the ambulance, and they saw my leg, and I saw their faces, and it was the first time I had an IV. And I fainted.
Oh, yes.
I fainted when they stuck
You wouldn't be the first, and you won't be the last.
No, but they were talking about amputating my leg.
Yeah.
I had an infection, and it was spreading so fast, it was already to my hip. And they were afraid that it was going to keep going up into my upper body.
Wow.
So they rushed me antibiotics, and thank God it went down. You know, after much debate, I ended up saying, you know what? They're right. I got things going on at home. I need to take care of the people who took care of me. I'll go home. It'll be easy. I'll get a job. Right? All these things I convinced myself. But that caused a lot of turmoil for me. And I spent 15 years drinking, fighting, trouble with the law, especially with the demographic that Jenny, Mike, and I work with. Trauma's trauma.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Now, granted, combat trauma is a different trauma, but ultimately, traumas have a lot of similarities.
Yes.
I can't say his trauma is invalid or her trauma is valid. We can't do that. Like, when we're treating people, we have to understand that what affects one person might not affect another person. Being injured, not fulfilling my dream, coming home, watching my grandfather die of Lou Gehrig's disease really took a toll on me.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't know how to process that then, but I have no shame in saying that. To this day, I'm still in therapy.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I still go to therapy to work. I've gotten comfortable with saying that I have complex PTSD, because we love to throw around words like PTSD and moral injury. And sometimes I don't feel like we talk enough about complex PTSD, right?
Which I've never even heard that term.
Starts in childhood.
And then often we're looking for family, and the military promotes that. And then when they don't fulfill it, that's another, like, whether you want to call it moral injury, there's so many layers to being a veteran, what happens to us, especially if the military betrays us, our family betrays us. And it could even be seen as a betrayal to Chris, too. Like, he wanted to be a lifer. Right. I wanted to be a lifer. And then when that dream ends, you're like, what now?
You feel lost.
Yeah, the loss.
Lose your sense of purpose. And I mean, that's a huge one. And then, basic training and boot camp are designed to break you down as an individual and to bring you into a structured environment where you're a part of something that's larger than yourself. That your primary concern is the guy on your right, the girl on your left, and whoever you are in combat or in the military with. You know, a lot of the trauma from younger years helps in that process, but a lot of that is alleviated because you get this new family, the family that you chose. and the family that you know is always going to be there in the worst of situations. These issues manifest themselves differently in different people. Like, I know I don't lose any sleep out of the things I had to do in Iraq, but I lose sleep about the fact that I had to buy six-year-old kids their first pair of shoes. Mm. Atrocities that exist, human rights violations, and then, you know, you come back and it manifests yourself. You know, I'm covered in tattoos. This is my therapy.
So that helps.
You know, yeah, some people, they go into the bottle. Some people go to, you know, it's different things for different people.
Yep. So I want you to talk about Battleborn, and, you know, you formed that. At some point, you reached clarity and were able to kind of get out of the troubling situation you were in.
Well, we can't talk about Battleborn without talking about Jenny or Mike, because, as you said, figured out how to get out of the trouble, and I didn't get out of anything. People helped me along the way. Mm. Many people. Jenny and I were a part of another nonprofit. We just saw other needs.
Yeah.
Other gaps. And as two people who met at a time we were both getting out of a lot of chaos.
You can say we were in addiction therapy together.
Mm, there you go.
So we met each other that right. way. Because mm-hmm. I think the story I would like to change for veterans is this trajectory of getting out of the military, dealing with addiction, incarceration, and all of that. But it's all of our stories. Mm. And then we figure it out. You know, Chris and I are out there being like, here is one of the answers before you go down that road.
Yeah.
Because like you stated earlier, Jenny said the stigmas, mm-hmm. right? And we forget, and this is by no way a means to shame the military, but when we come into that family, and a lot of times people don't want to say this, but drinking is encouraged mm-hmm. in the military.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know many people who return that don't have a drinking problem. So back to Battleborn, it was basically like you said, we figured out how to get out of it. And there's almost like this requirement to help the next person.
Mm-hmm.
Because not everybody can reach that addicted or alcoholic population. So that's where that niche comes in, where we understand,
yeah.
right? Yeah. So we felt this duty
yeah.
to start these organizations and work together, because there was a lot of nonprofits back then that just were silos. And Jenny and I are more like hubs. Yeah. So like she does what she does. Battleborn, Mike and I do what we do. And we work with Jenny so that we cannot tell veterans these words, which is what her and I heard at other nonprofits. Sorry, we don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because when you tell a vet or ready, a first responder, when you say, sorry, we don't do that, we know the courage it takes to ask for help.
Yes.
And those folks are not asking again.
Yeah, right. That's a wrap.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's over. It took all they could to do that. And as sad as it is to say, it's just the reality, they give up.
Yeah, makes you angry.
And then we know ultimately what happens.
It's important to talk about it.
We can talk about how...
It's important to say, I think I know where you're going.
Yeah.
Or you want to talk about the suicide rate
I do.
What we're losing with our veterans?
As a young man who lost his father to veteran suicide, you know, it's a difficult thing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. We can't avoid the question, right? We can't avoid it. But we will say this. In 2018, the number was 22 a day. Well, I'm happy to say we are down to 17.
Mm-hmm.
We have gotten so much over these last years of organizations becoming aware, it being talked about, SAVE trainings being implicated to teach providers, you know, community organizations like ours, people seeing, okay, these guys are working for that. 17 is still not a number I like, but it sure as heck is better than 22.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found that out of those 17, seven of those people use the VA, 10 do not.
Yeah.
I think it's safe that I can speak for them. I love the VA, okay? The VA saved my life and countless other people's lives. You know, people might have their aught with them, okay, no problem. But just imagine if those 10 that we lose had that access to some sort of health care.
Mm-hmm.
Could that have made a difference?
Right, yeah.
Right? We don't know.
Yeah.
So Battleborn was founded with the intent on helping people who maybe didn't have a smooth transition,
mm-hmm.
and now they're floundering around
mm-hmm.
because we come from this community, camaraderie. I got your back. You got mine. Your life depends on me. My life depends on you. We come back to civilian no matter how long you served. And it's not like that here. You lose that sense of feeling a part of.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So if we can't provide the service at Battleborn, we're going to take you to someone who can.
Yeah.
And like Jenny said, this is paramount. Both our organizations serve the families because we forget as a society, when veterans serve, so do their families.
Yes. Yeah.
The divorce rates.
Yeah.
The fights, the monetary situations.
I could touch on the suicide issue. It's one of those things that people don't want to touch, obviously, but it's right in our face. It's the elephant in the room. You know, my experience when I came back, my unit, my brigade had the highest suicide rate in the entire military at the time. It was unbelievable. I mean, you're talking about suicides in the barracks. And we've lost more guys to suicide than we did in combat.
Yeah.
And that's military-wide. And we're talking about 5,000 to 6,000 service members lost in combat to 3-5 times that now with suicide rates. A big problem is it's the civilian reaction is a double-edged sword. So you have, okay, we got to destigmatize help. We got to get these guys help. They're all damaged. They're victims. We need to do this. There's overwhelming force from the civilian world that we're hurt puppies now.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be touched with kid gloves. Then that's the rise of red flag laws.
Wellness checks.
Yeah, wellness checks. You know,
wellness checks.
Random wellness checks by people because they can't get a hold of you for 2 days and they're watching all these commercials about suicide.
And now here comes
and
the
all
cops
you're doing is you're
your
door. And you're on a fishing trip. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's that side, and then there is the other side where it's still among some of the older veterans that got when I came in, even when I returned, it was you're having nightmares, here's a 12-pack. So then the pendulum swings the opposite way where it's the kid glove stuff now. And there needs to be middle ground. It needs to wash back to where people understand that we knew what we were getting ourselves into. We do need help, and a lot of us are starting to reach out now, but the overwhelming idea that all of us are damaged to the point where we need to be overly medicated by the VA, all of a sudden it's the veteran has a problem, it's because of him, he needs to be locked up. I went through it, and I spent almost 18 months incarcerated because of a red flag law issue in Florida. They don't listen to you either.
Mm-mm.
It's this is what you're labeled as now because this is what everybody says it is. You know, it's not the individual story. It's the objectivity of this guy's a veteran. He's got PTSD. He needs to be locked up.
Yeah.
And that translates to the civilian job market, too, because nobody, when they see that you're a veteran, is like, I don't know if I want to hire this person because they might freak out and smack somebody.
And that's why we took our programming into the prisons.
Mm-hmm.
So our program doubles as reintegration and reentry. And the first thing I say to those incarcerated veterans is, you were trained to respond to a threat with violence as a reflex. This is in your brain, and you were never retrained to do anything different. Then you add the alcohol and the stress, and then here we are. Yes, you made a choice, and also you were set up to fail.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And I hate to say this, but vets give misinformation to other vets. Oh, don't do to the VA. Stay away from the VA. They'll take your guns. They'll lock you up. No. Like Jenny said, we want to get you connected to that health care, even if you don't stay there, but it's your free health care.
Yeah.
It's. I don't want to say like you're entitled, you're right. That's
what
we
earned it.
We get that.
We earn these benefits.
Right.
You know, some people
must use them.
They start at the VA. Yeah. Then when they get a job, they get private insurance and they choose to or not. But you at least should have that.
Yeah.
Because what happens when the you know what hits the fan and you don't have anywhere to go or who to talk to?
Right. That's not the time to start navigating the system.
No, it's a very difficult system. And they don't, unfortunately, tell you what to do. It's the vets that have... like Jenny, Mike, and myself that say, listen, guys, stop. The VA is not scary. Yep.
All right. So we are out of time. I feel like we scratched the surface here. So I'll be thinking about
we'll be
how to continue these conversations. So I want to thank our veterans that are here with us today. Jenny, Mike, and Chris, thank you for your service. Thank you for your continued service to our community and your fellow vets. And we hope to continue this conversation. You've been listening to Valley Voices on WDIY. I'm your host, Margaret McConnell, and have a great night.